Welcome to the Agile Revolution. This is Craig. We're at YAR 2015 in Sydney, the final leg in the final slot of the final day. So I've been here for a long time, Anne-Marie. We're sitting here. I can't believe we've gone over 100 episodes on this podcast, and I bang on about quality so much, and I haven't got Anne-Marie Charrett on the podcast. How are you doing?
I'm doing fantastic. Thank you very much, Craig, and I'm here to change that for you.
Absolutely. Yeah, let's bring it on. There's so many good... tracking down good testing people around the world. I try to do that whenever I'm overseas, and we know sort of some of those people, like Elizabeth Hendrickson and James Bark and those type of people. Not actually, I've had either of those on the podcast either. So yes, you're
there
starting
we go.
The trend.
Well, let me know if you get a few more on. I'm sure I can help you out with that.
Excellent. So there's a bit of an accent there. I mean, we're here in Australia, but Australia is not your home country.
No, not at all. So I guess I moved over here in the early 90s, mostly because of a broken heart. And
so that's why all good moves started.
It had to be done. But it was just opened up a whole new world, and it's that thing where you think that your life's about to end, and suddenly, here I am, nearly, 25 years later, and this is definitely home. Though I have jumped backwards and forwards a few times back to Dublin, but
Excellent. So how do you, the question I always want to ask testers, because, as we know, you can go to university, you can go do computer science, you can go do business, that gets you into business analysis, that gets you into programming, but testers kind of fit in that, where do they come from? So how did you fall into testing?
Okay, well, I like to say that testing chose me, actually, rather than the other way around. I did engineering at university. I wanted to be an engineer since I was 13. So this was, I had a Commodore 64. And, I was just really keen. I loved solving problems. That was in my heart, in my genetic makeup. I left university and at the time of the recession, and ended up working in a job where I had to test protocols. And I loved it. It was just, it was just the beauty of having something that was very logical. I mean, protocols, it's all about standards and, ones and zeros. But on the other hand, there's no point having a set of protocols if the two bits of equipment don't talk to each other. So at the end of the day, you've got the systems thinking that you have to adopt, and you have to make the system work, but you've also got the logical binary black and white thinking as well. And it was just that combination of the two that I really loved, and I was hooked. And just really been doing it ever since. Went to Nortel Networks when I arrived in Australia. Worked in Wollongong testing their intelligent networks, and that was these massive machines. And if you think about distributed systems, that was big stuff. And but it was really, really interesting, and I learned a lot about process. This was the first time someone had talked to me about process and having a formalized test strategy. Before then, it was all about automated test suites. And thinking up tests, but nothing was ever formalized. And I discovered all these sort of documents that had to be written. And I actually learned an awful lot from them. I mean, I think, people are very quick to ridicule big processes and stuff, but there's a very systematic thinking that you can learn by looking at the rigor that you apply to some of this. And that certainly stood by me for a long time. And even today, when in this world of Agile, these ideas that came from that are still really valuable for me. I don't have a massive document, but I still have a systematic way of thinking and approaching and challenging my ideas. And I laugh when people talk about sort of things like the Three Amigos, and having, let's get the tester and the BA and the business person and the developer together and we'll chat. And I'm like, we did that in 95.
Yeah.
This is not new stuff.
That's an interesting thing, conversing with the other people.
Yeah.
The guy who writes the software and the person who came up with the requirements. Why would I talk to them?
Yes. So, I think there's these wonderful things that will happen. I think it's too easy to kind of look back, and that's why I love some of the talks today, especially Dave Thomas, and, really just a sort of insight into people who developed, people who used Waterfall. These were not stupid people. Mm. You know, they were very intelligent.
The V model was test-driven development, really, if you think about it. Because you start at the requirements, and that's what drives your acceptance testing, and then you move down to your to when they're starting to do the system requirements, and that was the system testing. It's just the problem with the V model was nobody ever followed the V model, right? Everything kind of kept cascading down, and us poor testers were sitting at the end, going, "Don't worry, she'll be right. You know, it'll come to you." So we couldn't do that test-driven development because the big upfront requirements documents didn't allow us to do it.
Yeah, I think definitely that's part of it, but I think also. Oh, don't start me on the V model, because I mean, I think the trouble with the V model, it gave an illusion that it was simple, that if you just followed these few steps that you would actually be able to have a really well done testing process. And the reality, of course, is that, you know, there's no such thing as a V. It's a more of a triple W, the reality is things constantly change, and it's impossible to follow something like that. Mm. So I think that,
the thinking was there. Right.
We've always
been thinking about it. You're right. It was never, no one ever followed it. People who hold on to waterfall, it's like, well, what are you really holding on to?
Yeah, what is that wonderful talk about? Was it stochastic?
Thriving Stochastic World by Don Reinerston, yeah.
That's the one. And, it was just that deterministic thinking that it's a very simple way. I actually gave a talk on that a couple of years ago, very similar to that, because, we have this deterministic thinking in testing. We think it's all going to be really simple, but at the end of the day, life's not like that. Mm. Testing's certainly not like that. And I loved the talk about how many dimensions do you need in order to look at the problem solving space in designing a product. There's an infinite amount of different dimensions, and now try and test those infinite dimensions, and you start getting a sense of the challenges that you've got ahead of you. And yet we sort of fall to these simplistic acceptance criteria. Well, I'll just write three acceptance criteria and then we'll be fully sorted, right? Mm. And I really wish it was that easy.
Yeah.
I'm sure you do too. Mm. It's not that acceptance criteria are inherently bad things in themselves, but I think the trouble is that people sort of look at that and say, well, that's all I have to do and then I'll be done. And for me, the beauty is actually what's unsaid, what's not there, what's behind the acceptance criteria, what's the innuendo, what's the all the hidden sort of grayness that fascinate me about stories, because stories are really about people, and people are never black and white. And just trying to fully understand all that makes the problem solving space just really complex and beautiful and wonderful.
So one of the, you work quite often quite closely with people like James Bark, and he comes from this context driven school of testing, which I know you subscribe to. Do you think one of the things that I find the testing community, unfortunately, is people think that their job is to produce lots of reports or to write lots of documents to prove they're being busy?
Mm.
How do people get out of that trap? Because unfortunately, that's the illusion that testing has to a lot of leaders and managers. And I'm sure some of our listeners out there that all they see is a tester, continually manually testing the same stuff over and over and producing reports and trying to get the attention of people, which is really not what it's about at all.
No, it's not. I mean, like, testing is a verb. It's a doing thing. It's not actually an output. And I think the trouble is that, unfortunately, a lot of testers conflate those two things as well. Mm. And that certainly doesn't help. There are a lot of intelligent people out there who do understand what testing is, developers and testers. I think I work with a few developers who have great insight into testing. Mm. I think that there is a huge challenge that you cannot see doing.
Mm.
Even with development, you have the output is code. You have some written code to demonstrate that you've done something, but testing, you might have a bug, but the chances are you might not.
No bugs, but there might be bugs.
But I think it's really the onus is on the tester, really, to be able to tell that story. And I think it's not good enough to, even just because no one's asking that story, that you assume that story doesn't have to be told. Because I think that people will make up their own story anyway.
Mm.
So I think testers have to be get really good at explaining why they're doing things. I think they have to use their communication skills, and I think most testers actually have strong communication skills. So I think they should practice that, practice talking about it. And it's scary and it's challenging, but you just practice until you get to the point where you can have a podcast with you, Craig, and talk about testing. I mean, I was terrified about talking about stuff like this, and not a hugely assertive person, and yet, you know, I feel very passionate about it, and because of that, that's brought me to the point where I feel quite confident talking about stuff like this, but it certainly wasn't the case even five years ago, you know. So practice, and it's just not good enough. You have to, you know, at this day and age, this is our bread and butter, and you've got to be, this is one of the key skill sets that we require, I think.
You said you were lucky enough to, when you came out here, to work for an organization that introduced you to all these concepts. One of the things that worries me now in our agile world is that because the pace of us doing testing has become so much faster, that some of those core concepts, perhaps someone joining the workforce as a tester might lose out in the same way that things like test-driven development have eroded unit testing a little bit. And you know, you understand it if we've been through the process of doing it manually and going automated. We've got things like ISTQB and these things out there. How does someone who wants to go into testing get those core competencies to understand them in 2015, 2016, where we are now?
That's a great question. You take my class in exploratory testing.
Nice plug, well done.
But I think it is about understanding the core skills, and then being able to adapt those core skills into an agile context. So we don't want a massive test strategy document. I certainly don't want to write it, and I know people don't want to read it. So that's definitely not the future. But it's like, what is the thinking behind? What was that document trying to achieve? What's the thinking there? And to pull that out and then be able to apply that into an agile context is a really powerful skill. And unfortunately, there's not a lot of classes that do teach that. I was teaching that at university for a couple of years, and it met with enormous success for the 2 years I was doing that. Unfortunately, the class got too popular, and so it got too big, and you can't teach sustainably. That type of training is not manageable on large scale. And so, I don't know if I've got an easy answer for that. I think a lot of practice comes with coaching. Like when I'm working at the moment with Tyro Payments, we have a huge emphasis on training and coaching. We tried a number of different ways of doing it, but we're constantly supporting the testers, helping them to try and upskill. We're also working with developers as well, so to helping them understand a bit about what testing is, and with the idea that the tester coaches the developers to the point where they can become dispensable in a way, because I know that no matter what, there's always going to be risk. The risk is going to be might look differently in 6 months' time. So I don't have that fear of running out of a job, because where there's risk and where there's failure, I have a job.
Well, yeah, I don't think to be fair, it's that we can become dispensable. It means that we can go and do more value-added activities. So instead of, you know, having to regression test everything every iteration or run the same test over and over, for example, it means that perhaps you can, you know, go and do some exploratory testing on a more regular basis, or go and find some new tools that'll make things a lot easier.
Well, one thing that's been really interesting I've discovered is that a lot of the time I see risk. So I spend all my time thinking about risk. I'm really good at thinking about where it might potentially fail, and that's what testers do. Developers are fantastic at creating code, and they become so skilled at it that it makes sense for them to code software. It makes, you know, in the same way as for me, software testers spend all their day thinking about how things might go wrong. And so they become really skilled at smelling out potential failures. And so what I found that I'm doing at Tyro Payments is that I will identify a risk, but then I'll work with the developers who will go out and help solve that problem of finding the risk. So it's a really beautiful combination of testers and developers working together, giving them sort of helping identify the problem, they go, oh, wow, yeah, that's a problem. Right, let's get a team onto that and let's try and focus on fixing that. And I think that's a beautiful synergy of an example of how testers and developers can work together in an agile context.
So there's a whole bunch of things I know you for, so I'm going to quick fire some things.
Okay, go for it.
Exploratory testing.
Yeah.
To me, sometimes one of the most misunderstood parts of testing. What is your expert? How would you describe it to someone listening?
Oh, exploratory testing for me is, one of the definitions is testing design and execution in parallel, basically. I think that is a bit of a disservice to exploratory testing. For me, exploratory testing, the key thing is the feedback, right? Because you design a test, you think of a test, and then what happens is you execute that test, and then it's about learning from the output and using that learning to feed back into designing your next test. If you're doing that, you're doing exploratory testing. Mm. It doesn't necessarily mean it has to be all done in 5 minutes. Mm. I think that's a sort of, it doesn't do exploratory testing justice. Mm. I mean, I have times where I do exploratory testing where I feel totally empowered to sit down and develop maybe a mind map and develop a strategy and to think about potential risks. And then I go off and I start executing those tests. But I always allow what I learn to feedback into that strategy and to change it. So I'll feel quite comfortable once I've run a test and I'll go, oh, my assumptions in my test strategy were incorrect. I've learned something new. Let's refocus somewhere else. And that to me is exploratory testing. I think, you know, testers doing that, it suddenly opens up a whole world of different type of thinking.
But it's not, I think one of the things that I see is it's not, from the outside, people assume it's just thumping on the keyboard, right?
Yeah.
Let's hit there for an hour and let's hit the Q key 27 times and see if that breaks the system.
Yeah, and I guess that is a form of exploratory testing, you know, but it's a very simplistic one. Mm. I think we can go a lot deeper than that I think we can be a lot more considered about what we do. And, you know, there's no reason why we can't create large amounts of data and you know, there's a whole heap of different things we can do in our exploratory testing. It's a tool. Let's make it. It can be really powerful if we know how to use it in the right way.
All right. Next one. Agile testing. From people who are, I find lots of agile teams or just teams in general, as they start to go to this quicker turnaround, you know, whether they're doing sprints or continuous flow, they struggle with keeping up. So, do you have one piece of advice that for people if they're going down as a tester and they've been dragged into this agile world, what should they do?
Don't try and test everything. And don't try and automate everything.
Isn't that one of the principles of testing anyway? Exhaustive testing is impossible?
Well, it is impossible, but I think the attempt is, we might miss something, so let's try and cover everything. And we don't know, in the future we might break something, so let's try and cover everything that we might potentially break in the future. Mm-hmm. And I think that's an approach. And I think that you can try and do that. You'll be very busy. Your developer is probably be very busy creating automated tests or whatever. Or if you're doing that as well, you're going to be you're going to need a large team of people to do that. Mm. Certainly, but it's certainly an approach. For me, I prefer to adopt a risk-based approach to that and say, hang on, where are the key potential risks here? Is it really true that the key potential risk is in a potential bug in the future that might go wrong? Mm-hmm. Is it really worthwhile spending all that time and effort? If it is, let's do it. Mm-hmm. But if it's not, let's focus our energy somewhere else. And that way we can start making considered decisions about what we should and shouldn't test. But it takes a lot of courage. And it's much easier to go down the path of let's try and cover everything because we might miss something. Mm-hmm. But there lies madness in my view.
Yeah. All right. You mentioned before you're working now for Tyro Payments, who are, there's lots of organisations who are doing cool stuff, and then one of the organisations, particularly here in Sydney, who are, a good group of people, doing cool stuff and those type of things. So you're working with developers a lot closely, perhaps, than you have in the past. How important is unit testing?
How important is unit testing? How not important is unit testing, in my opinion? Mm-hmm. I think, we're an XP house. So
para for XP.
Yeah, yeah. We do para programming and TDD, and we don't, you know, we live and breathe TDD, but the output is we have those tests. We also have integration tests. I'm not sure if that's how useful is unit testing. I'm not sure. I think it has to depend on the tester mind in me is coming up now thinking, hang on a second, I've answered that way too quickly. I think it depends on it depends on the programmer. It depends on the context in which you're doing it. I mean,
It's gone in a pendulum, right? Is that when I first started developing, I have to unit test everything, and it was manual and horrible. Yeah. And it went away. It almost went away. And then XP came along, test-driven development came along. Yeah. We unit test the jeepers out of everything.
Yeah.
And then with mobile and cloud, we got quicker. And then I found it went away again. Right. People weren't doing it, and the quality suffered. But now I'm actually seeing lots of environments, people are just over-testing everything to the wazoo, and not the important stuff, not the things that... And so I'm in this sort of mindset of, you know, we kind of said, you should do this, and it's like, well, no, you shouldn't. And it's conflicting. I mean, even here at the conference, you know, property-based testing and a whole bunch of other things have been a topic. So
yeah, we've certainly had that discussion at Tyro. And we've looked at, you know, should we be creating tests for every class? You know, at that level, does that make sense? And certainly, I know that what we've done at Tyro is we've experimented with different approaches, and we found that some teams have found it very useful to just abstract out a little bit and not create unit tests for everything at that level. And they've certainly benefited from that. But I think you really you have to. Think about what you're trying to achieve when you're creating those tests. For a lot of the developers, the reason that they create these unit tests is to learn. They're trying to figure out, how do I design this product? Now, that's a very different purpose for their unit test than someone who's basically wants to constantly check that, is it still working?
Mm-hmm.
And so I think the key in a lot of this is to be able to refactor your tests as you go. Just because you've created them at the start doesn't mean that they should exist at the end. I think if you allow yourself that freedom to change your mind and to do something different, you'll get a much better class of a much better abstraction level of your unit testing.
One of the things that you've got a lot to do in the community here in Sydney, you ran the Sydney Testers Meetup group for a number of years, and it's a hugely successful group, and I know that's built on a lot of the really hard work and actually unseen work that you did. But more recently, you've turned your attention more to helping women in tech and done some really interesting things in that space. Tell us a little bit about how we get, you know, more females into our industry, because the statistics are still.
If I had the silver bullet, I'd be making heaps of money. No, I'll joke.
No, that's a silver phone. I thought that was the
Look, I'm fascinated by this, because this is not something I ever envisaged myself focusing on energy-wise. When I did engineering, for me, it was all about, all I'm going to do, it's basically, if I do a good job, I want to be judged on that. I don't want someone advocating for me. I don't want someone thinking, oh, she's there because she's a woman. It's like, I want to stand on my work. And I still do believe that. But I think the older I get, the more I sort of have come to the opinion that it's not that simplistic, and that it is actually, it can be really tough to get where you want to be. And there is discrimination, and it's not necessarily there on purpose, though sometimes it is, but that there are these biases that people are just not aware of that take place. So one of the things that I believe to get more women vocal, I think there are women out here who are in the industry already, and helping them to become more vocal, helping them to become speakers, helping them to become more visible, have more of a say. I think these are all really valuable things, but they're not just going to get there because just by people saying that's what we need. I think you need to help walk the journey with these people. And I think that's what really impressed me with Yeah was that you did that Women in Tech competition, and that's like you actually creating an opportunity for people just to take the first step. And I think if you do that, then you're giving them the tools that they need in order to develop those skills. And actually, on top of that, idea was Speakeasy came along. So I developed a volunteer organization.
That's what I'm moving to. I can't remember the name of it.
Yeah. So Speakeasy, basically, we go to the conferences and we say, please allocate one Speakeasy spot for people who have never spoken before. And most conferences are really, really happy to do that because it helps them. We then go to, we have mentors who will then, and then we have people who want to speak, and we match those together. And the testing community has just really taken this on board, and it's like so many people volunteering to help. It's been fantastic. And so they match with people who think they might want to speak. And the way that we framed it was, if you think you might want to speak but you don't have an idea, if you think you have an idea but you don't know how to put together a talk or an abstract, so even if you think you might possibly want to speak one day, sign up. Because sometimes it's really hard. You think, when you think that in order to speak, you think that I need to have something really special to say. You know, it's got to be really, everyone talks about this topic. I've got to find something really smart on top of that, or else everyone's going to think that I'm just copying someone. But what you discover, as I'm sure you're aware, is that once you've spoken for a few times, it's about your story. And everyone's got a story. You know, they've got their own story. And that's what it's all about. It's about sharing that journey. So I think just allowing people that, giving people that permission to start. And that's what we found, is that when people sign up, they only need a bit of mentoring. They actually don't need a lot of help. It's mostly being given permission, in a sense, to go. Or else it's just a little bit of confidence, a little bit of support for the first couple of times, and then they're off. So we've had 20 new speakers.
Wow.
Speaking 1 year that have never spoken before at a conference before, and that's
not just here in Australia. That's,
no, this is world. This is across the world, and this is just. I think it's a true sign of the community that we work in. That, you know, I mean, I think the tech community, to be honest, I think we're incredibly supportive, and people have a natural desire that they want to help, and they want to make it better, and I think it's tapped into that. And, you know, you look at the conferences and they've just been amazing, really amazing support. The first conference that we signed up with took 5 people.
Wow.
You know, I mean, that was just incredible. It was like, wow, no, give us more. Like, we've only got 6.
we can only get people so through so fast.
Yeah, so that's just been amazing to do that. And it's been very, very rewarding to see.
And more recently, you've also been doing some interesting stuff locally.
Yeah, in my spare time. Yeah. So one of the things that I've been working on is training marginalized youths with an organization called Work Ventures. And Work Ventures they're based out in Mascot, and they help basically people who've run out of luck. They've dropped out of high school. They, for one reason or other, they just haven't been able to complete their education. But they're smart. They're really smart. And they've helped these people find their way back. And then I jump in at the end, and I give them some training in software testing. And we've had about 4 of them come through the program. They're now, they've been doing some work at Suncorp. I'm sure Suncorp won't mind if I mention that. But they've been doing some 3 weeks there, and they've just been fantastic. And the feedback that we've got has been really good, and they're very impressed with the quality of these people. And I think such a simple, small thing to do, and you've just changed 4 people's lives, and you've gotten them a job. And I don't think things get better than that, to be honest, when you know that you can help in a small way. I mean, they've done it all themselves, but you've just helped. You've been a little bit of support along the way. So that's been really, really rewarding. And But we're also looking for sponsors to help us with that Kickstart program, because we really want to grow that and make that into something that we can help more children with, more youth. So
the one thing, listen to these stories, and we were talking about testing earlier. What can we do as a testing community and an agile community to get more people interested in testing? Because it worries me that we've got such a cool skill set here that I just don't think, kids in school, they think about it as I have to go and learn some in-depth program later. I have to be really smart to do it, to do that kind of thing. The problem-solving aspect is awesome. What can we do? You got any thoughts on...
I haven't actually thought a lot about it, to be honest, but I do... When I do see this emphasis on coding, I do worry a little bit. I mean, I think it's great. Don't get me wrong. I think it's wonderful that people are wanting to train younger people on how to code. But it's certainly not for everyone. It certainly wasn't for me. I was a programmer for 6 months and absolutely hated it. My hat's off to anyone who programs that. There's a beauty in that I'm jealous that but it's certainly not my strength.
I just wonder whether that image turns away lots of girls early in their career, because that's the illusion of what the tech industry is. When we have awesome stuff like testing.
Yeah, I haven't really thought about it, to be honest. We actually, James Back and I went to, and this wasn't particularly kids, women, but we went into a primary school 1 year to teach critical thinking skills.
I have an image of James Back walking to a primary school and if anyone's met James, he can certainly argue a point. I can just imagine all these.
It was really interesting. I have to send you the article, but it was all about critical thinking skills, because really at the heart of it, testing is about critical thinking. And these kids were from 7 to, I think, 12, up to year 6. And they were incredibly smart. They're just their problem solving, their critical thinking skills were amazing. So what we do is we got these cereal boxes, right, Fruit Loops, and we pulled out the Fruit Loops out, and we got this dried fruit and we put it in, right, and then we said, what's in this box? And we had two boxes. One was actually full of Fruit Loops and the other one was with this dried loops of fruit. And so we said, what's this? What's in here? And they went, it's Fruit Loops, it's cereal, da 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 da. And James goes, are you sure? Are you sure it's fruit? How do you know? And so they were like, open the box. So they ripped the box over and then they pulled out, and sure enough, there was these Fruit Loops in. And so then he swapped the boxes and he said, well, okay, so let's ask this question again. What's this? And they were like, that's the same thing. Well, it's like, how do you know? And they're like, it's the same. And then someone said, what happens if they're not Fruit Loops? What happens if they're loops of fruit? And it was just, this came out of an 8-year-old, and it's like, wow, they're the problem solving, the critical thinking skills are there. I don't know how to develop that, but it is a concern that if that's the only thing people think about tech. Now you've given me something else to think about, Craig.
Sorry. You do so much already, so I don't want to put that burden on you. Maybe a listener can pick that up.
Yeah, please.
Or something. last thing I want to ask you, I could sit here for another hour talking to you. What's piquing your interest in the testing community? What sort of cool things are you seeing coming down the pipe? What things should we be keeping an eye on?
I'm heavily involved in microservices at the moment, like a lot of places.
This conference is kind of like a... I think if you didn't have a talk that mentioned microservices, then I think you had to take a shot or something. I don't know.
I actually do have a talk on microservices, Craig. But... I think there's a really interesting challenge in that, because it's, again, going back to the risk. And the thing that concerns me about microservices is that there's this view of bounded context. And it's, we're just going to do everything we need in isolation, and we're going to make sure it works. And as long as we have the API and we're agreed and we have a shared understanding of what the API is, everything's going to be fine. But my concern is that the sum of the parts is great. The sum of the parts is not as great as a whole.
Mm.
And that we need to have a really holistic view of, are we actually solving our customers' needs? Mm. You know, there's a fundamental question here that is very hard to answer when you look at all the little pieces.
Mm.
And certainly my experience is that there's areas that of risk that are not addressed
mm.
when we look at things in isolation.
Yeah, I think the problem is, I've been thinking about this, and I spoke to James Lewis on another podcast that you'll hear on the channel somewhere around this one, because there is a very agile point to Microsoft as well, break things in small chunks,
mm-hmm.
being able to deliver these things quickly. But when you look at some, we talk about Conway's Law, where your organisational context matches what you deliver, what seems to happen in a lot of the organisational structures that do that is they lose the voice of the customer, because all you're worried about is the input and the output, which is really dangerous.
I think so, and I think that's what certainly, in some ways you have to, when you're developing, is you have to think about it in those terms, because you'll go crazy looking at all the different other aspects. But someone has to be thinking that.
Yeah.
Someone's got to be looking at that. And, it's that classic case of breaking things down but missing the whole. Mm. That's my experience.
Mm.
So microservices have been fascinating to look at as a testing challenge. Mm. I think the other thing that, as a social thing, is testers and developers working together. It's just been a hugely fascinating insight for me, is how do you really work to improve the quality of a product when you've got people who hopefully think differently but still need to work in an environment where there's just a slightly this healthy conflict where that's recognized, and that you can keep that going and deliver quickly with good quality. I think that's a huge challenge. And I think it can be really tough for people. Mm. And what I'm learning is that there's a lot of room for kindness and forgiveness. And I think if we can just be humans rather than agilists, or I think we could probably do a lot better in delivering quality. But
can't say any better than that. Great talking to you. If people want to know more about stuff, so let's roll them off. If people want to know about Speakeasy, how do they get involved or find out more about that?
Okay, so the best place is speakeasy.com. So that's with a hyphen. So if you go to that website, you can sign up. Mm-hmm. If you're a conference, you can basically register your interest. If you are a tester or a tech person who wants to become better in speaking, sign up. We are a voluntary organization, so do please be patient. Mm-hmm. We will get to you and we will match you with someone, and hopefully we'll start a wonderful career and we'll hear you speaking at Yow.
Excellent.
It should be fantastic.
And if people want to know more about you, ask people that might want to help out with the talking about the youth and privileged youth.
Yeah, the Work Ventures is the organization for there. I don't actually have their details mm-hmm. with me, but I mean, just Google that ventures, and you'll find Work Ventures. Amazing people there, mm-hmm. just doing incredible work. And finally, then, if you want to find out of my testing philosophies, would be mavericktester.com.
Mm-hmm.
And you can have a read about some of the stuff I think about there.
Excellent. Well, awesome. Well, been great catching up
thanks.
With you.
Yep.
And great to see you again. And and if you're ever at a testing conference or just here in the corridor, make sure you have a chat to Anne-Marie. She's a wealth of knowledge and does awesome stuff for our community. So thank you.
Okay. Well, it's been a pleasure. Thanks, Craig.
Cheers.
Yeah.